Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 16. Our Temple of Justice is a slave pen. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. And this week, we're going to continue our story of the Fugitive Slave Act and the efforts of black and white abolitionists in Boston to resist what they saw as an unjust law. In last week's show, we discussed how Lewis Hayden and the Vigilance Committee rescued the fugitive Shadrach Minkins from being returned to slavery. This week, we're going to learn how that act of resistance led to a federal crackdown in Boston, look at two unsuccessful rescues that followed, and see how the unrest galvanized the apathetic population of Boston into a hotbed of radical abolitionism.
But first, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is February 13th, and on February 13th, 1776, the Continental Army repelled an attack by British forces along Dorchester Neck. The British rowed across the shallow harbor in longboats, before burning homes and property in what is today South Boston. About 300 mounted Continentals soon met the British party and forced them back to their boats with light casualties. It would be the last time the British attempted to break out of the besieged city before Henry Knox's cannons were emplaced on Dorchester Heights, forcing the British to evacuate Boston on March 17th.
We had a nice little blizzard this past week, with about a foot of snow in many parts of the city. However, the memory of the terrible winter of 2015 is still very fresh in our minds. When the Valentine's Day blizzard struck Boston on February 14, 1940, it was the worst storm the city had seen in 50 years. The weather forecast for the day had predicted rain and light snow, so people were completely unprepared. People went to work in their offices or factories just for a mild storm and got stranded after 2 feet of snow fell, along with heavy wind-driven gusts. Some made their way home through the storm, while many were stranded in place for days, as an army of shovelers from the Works Progress Administration dug out the city. We'll post pictures of the pedestrians, mostly women, braving the storm in the show notes for this week's episode at hubhistory.com/016. In contrast with last week's storm, and with the Great Valentine's Day blizzard of 1940, John Adams wrote in his journal on February 16, 1756, quote, "A most beautiful morning. We have the most moderate winter that was ever known in this country. For a long time together, we have had serene and temperate weather, and all the roads perfectly settled and smooth, like summer."
Wednesday is February 15th, and that's the date in 1941 when the last streetcar rumbled through Copley Square and down Huntington Avenue before the subway opened. We'll post a beautiful picture of a Huntington Avenue car passing through Copley Square in this week's show notes. It's also the anniversary of the rescue of Shadrach Minkins from slave hunters in Boston. Make sure to listen to last week's episode to learn more if you haven't already.
Friday is February 17th. A bill was proposed before the Massachusetts legislature on February 17th, 1898, that would have limited the height of all buildings in and around Copley Square to 80 feet. The proposed statute said, "The extreme height to which any building may be erected in that part of Boston bounded by Berkeley Street, Newbury Street, Exeter Street, and the Boston and Albany and Boston and Providence Railroads, and including the two squares in said city known as Copley Square, shall be 80 feet, exclusive of such steeples, towers, domes, cornices, parapets, balustrades, sculptured ornaments, chimneys, and roofs, as the Board of Park Commissioners of said city may approve." Of course, today, the tallest building in the city of Boston is located squarely in the middle of that zone. The building formerly known as Hancock Tower tips the scales at 790 feet, or basically 10 times what would have been allowed under that law.
In a letter to Abigail on February 18, 1776, John Adams revealed his true thoughts on the prospects for a speedy peace and on Southerners. "Reconciliation, if practicable, and peace, if attainable, you very well know would be as agreeable to my inclinations and as advantageous to my interests as to any man's. But I see no prospect, no probability, no possibility. And I cannot but despise the understanding, which sincerely expects an honorable peace for its credulity, and detest the hypocritical heart, which pretends to expect it when in truth it does not. The newspapers here are full of free speculations, which have been long in contemplation and fully understood by the people at large in New England, but have been attended to in the southern colonies only by gentlemen of free spirits and liberal minds, who are very few. We'll have a link to the full text of that letter in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/016.
Finally, Sunday is February 19th, which is the anniversary of the Massachusetts Historical Society. Though it was technically founded in 1791, MHS was incorporated on February 19th, 1794. Our state has always recognized the value of history, and by 1794 saw the importance of chartering an organization to record the history of our state and our nation. It's now the oldest organization in the U.S. dedicated to collecting primary sources of U.S. history, and it's an invaluable source of materials for this show.
This week, we continue our story of Boston's resistance to the Unjust Fugitive Slave Act. After the Boston mob, led by Lewis Hayden, was able to deliver Shadrach Minkins out of the federal courthouse and into freedom in Canada, federal authorities vowed never to allow a similar rescue again. President Fillmore was willing to use federal troops to prevent fugitives from being rescued, a policy that would continue under his successor, Franklin Pierce. Even after the rescue of Shadrach Minkins, abolition would remain a minority position in Massachusetts. A vocal one, but a minority nonetheless. Events over the next few years, though, would take popular sentiment from a wishy-washy unionism, willing to collaborate with the slave power to maintain the status quo, to a broadening sympathy for abolition, and then to a widespread adoption of radical, rabid abolitionism. The sort of radicalism that borders on a religious fervor, and was ready to drive the country into a bloody civil war to finally answer the unfinished business of slavery.
Thomas Sims made his way to Boston in March of 1851, just a month after Shadrach Minkins had been rescued from slave catchers in this city. Sims stowed away on a ship from his native Savannah, Georgia, and managed to stay out of sight of the crew until they were entering Boston Harbor. The young man, some sources say he was 23, others say he was just 17, was brought before the captain, then locked in a cabin as the ship anchored in the outer harbor. That night, he was able to pick the lock on the cabin bulkhead, steal one of the ship's lifeboats, and row his way to shore in South Boston. He found lodging in a colored seaman's boarding house and began trying to build a new life. He had trouble finding work immediately and made the fatal mistake of wiring friends in Savannah to advance him some money. A week later, an agent of James Potter, who claimed to be Thomas Sims' lawful owner, arrived in Boston and obtained a warrant for Sims' arrest. On April 3rd, Boston police seized Sims, who struggled as though his life depended on it, and stabbed one of the officers in the process. He was locked up in Boston's federal courthouse to await his fate. Boston's abolitionist community moved quickly to provide Sims with legal counsel, but was divided over what further measures were necessary. Some radicals believed that immediate action was needed to free him, as the federal court would have no choice but to return him to slavery under the law they saw as unjust. A great many moderates, however, had been disturbed and embarrassed by the effort to free Shadrach Minkins. They opposed slavery, but they also considered it their patriotic duty to work within the law of the land, even laws passed to support slave power.
A white Worcester minister, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, became frustrated with the abolitionist crowd's inaction. He hatched a plan, a long shot, and on April 9th entrusted the African-American minister Leonard Grimes with a key role in the plot. Grimes was a pastor of the 12th Baptist Church, a Roxbury church that was deeply tied to the abolition movement, and generations later would be Martin Luther King Jr.'s church during his years in Boston. He had been a free man in Virginia, and had served 2 years in a Richmond prison for his role as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, helping dozens of enslaved people find their way north. Importantly, Grimes was allowed to minister to Sims's soul while he was confined in the courthouse. Higginson entrusted him with a message for Sims. That night, he should remain awake and dressed. In the wee hours of the morning, he should move to the window of his third-story cell as though needing fresh air. At a signal from below, he would jump out the window and land on a pile of mattresses that Higginson and his group had stashed nearby, ready to drag to the courthouse wall. A carriage would be standing by, and Lewis Hayden's proven conduit to the Underground Railroad would carry Sims north to Canada. As they waited for dark, however, the plan came undone. Masons fitted iron bars over the windows of Thomas Sims's cell, and without his leap into the night, There could be no hope of rescue. Now the courthouse windows were barred, and the entire building was draped in chains. Attorney Richard Henry Dana, who had worked on Shadrach Minkin's defense and was now working on Sims's defense, watched from his office window as federal authorities fortified the courthouse, saying, "Our temple of justice is a slave pen."
On April 11th, the federal court issued an injunction stating for the record that Sims was the personal chattel of James Potter, clearing the way for him to be returned to Georgia. The judge said, "This is the whole of the evidence, and I must say it leaves no room whatever for a doubt that the prisoner before me is the identical person described in the record as having escaped from Georgia while owing service to James Potter. Having thus stated the conclusions to which I have come upon all questions raised in this case, I have only to add that I can entertain no doubt whatever that it is my duty to grant to the claimant the certificate which he demands, and I do accordingly grant it. I feel it to be a public duty, in closing this decision, to express here my deep obligation to the Marshal of the United States and to the Marshal of the City of Boston and the various officers serving under them for the efficiency and prudence with which they have discharged their respective duties connected with or occasioned by this hearing." As Sims awaited his fate, Boston abolitionists attempted to buy his freedom. Vigilance Committee member Francis Jackson described it in a letter to a friend. "At the time of the rendition of Sims, money enough was raised and pledged to ransom him, but Mr. Potter refused to sell him at any price. He demanded that the case should be executed and Sims should go back. He wanted to humble Boston, and he did most thoroughly. A simple slaveholder of Savannah had all the city officials and police force harnessed to his work at their own cost, and he spurned their money."
Just after 3 a.m. on April 12th, Thomas Sims was pulled from his cell. Members of the Vigilance Committee had been in an all-night meeting nearby and began to gather at the courthouse. 100 police officers surrounded the prisoner, armed with Roman-style double-edged short swords that the U.S. Marshal had borrowed from the Charlestown Navy Yard. Around the police officers, another 100 volunteers gathered, armed with hooks, clubs, and whatever they could lay their hands on. An hour before dawn, this ragged phalanx began to move down State Street, trailed by as many as 200 abolitionists. Sims held his head high, though tears were visible on his cheeks. The abolitionist crowd hissed shame, while making, as one observer said, no other attempt at disorder. They arrived at the waterfront and the ship waiting to take Sims back into slavery. As Sims was forced aboard the Acorn, a voice called out from the crowd saying, "Sims, preach liberty to the slaves." Sims responded with a rebuke, the last words he spoke in Massachusetts before being conveyed back into bondage. "And is this Massachusetts liberty?" As the ship pushed back from the dock at almost exactly 5 a.m., Reverend Daniel Foster urged the crowd to kneel and pray for the poor brother who was carried by force to the land of whips and chains. It was the first time a fugitive was delivered from Boston back into slavery, a victory of slave power over the New England abolitionists.
Soon, word came back from Georgia that Thomas Sims had arrived. A week after he left Boston, Sims was chained up in a public square in Savannah and lashed 39 times across his bare back. The date was April 19th, exactly 76 years since the Revolutionary War began at Lexington and Concord. Frederick Douglass, who our president recently recognized as...
Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
Commented on the terrible bargain struck by Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster that resulted in the Fugitive Slave Act. "Let heaven weep and hell be merry. Daniel Webster has at last obtained from Boston a living sacrifice to appease the slave god of the American Union." A year later, posters and handbills went up around the city advertising a citywide rally to commemorate the anniversary of Sims' kidnapping and show that the love of freedom is not only preserved as a sacred flame in New England, but is spreading through and warming the hearts of all its people. The wound to Boston's pride had been deep and raw. It had been previously possible for moderates and the politically apathetic to ignore the outrage of Shadrach Minkin's arrest and to dismiss his rescue as a dangerous act of violence and anarchy. But with Thomas Sims' return to slavery, it became almost impossible to remain neutral. The public reaction to Sims' arrest began to swing popular opinion slowly but definitively in favor of abolition. Just weeks after the Sims trial, Daniel Webster was defeated in a Senate re-election campaign by the radical abolitionist Charles Sumner.
3 years after the shame of the Sims case, Boston abolitionists were faced with another fugitive trial, another attempt to free a fugitive, and another failure. Anthony Burns was the youngest of 13 children born to slavery in rural Stafford County, Virginia. His father died while Burns was an infant, from inhaling the stone dust in a quarry where he was forced to work. His mother was a cook who was sold away to a distant town when Anthony was about 5 years old. His owner, Charles Suttle, put him to work at the age of 6, hiring him out to other families in the area for domestic work. As a teenager, he was hired out to a sawmill, where he received a terrible injury from the steam-powered blade that would disfigure his hand and arm for the rest of his life, and eventually serve as an identifying mark that Suttle could use to lay claim to Burns when he arrived in Boston. Suttle continued to hire him out in different forms of labor until he eventually came to work for a druggist in Richmond, Virginia. This new career gave him some freedom of movement in the city, and he was able to arrange an escape to freedom. He befriended a sailor and was able to stow away on a ship bound for Boston. After a stormy passage of 3 weeks, Anthony Burns arrived in Boston in March of 1854. After moving to Boston, Burns found work in a Brattle Street shop owned by a man named Coffin Pitts. Once he was settled in, he sent a letter to his brother urging him to also seek freedom in the North. Unfortunately, although he had tried to conceal the origin of the letter, it was intercepted and given to Charles Suttle. Rather than sending a slave hunter, as the owners of Shadrach Minkins and Thomas Sims had, Suttle came to Boston himself. On May 24th, while he was walking home from work, Anthony Burns heard footsteps behind him. "When I was going home one night, I heard someone running behind me. Presently, a hand was put on my shoulder and somebody said, 'Stop, stop. You are the fellow who broke into a silversmith's shop the other night.' I assured the man that it was a mistake, but almost before I could speak, I was lifted off my feet by 6 or 7 others, and it was of no use to resist. In the courthouse, I waited some time, and as the silversmith did not come, I told them I wanted to go home to supper. A man then came to the door. He didn't open it like an honest man would, but he kind of slowly opened it and looked in. The man at the door was Charles Suttle. He called Burns by name and asked, 'Haven't I always treated you well, Tony? Haven't I always given you money when you needed?' To which Burns responded angrily, 'You have always given me 12.5 cents once a year.' This statement was seen as an acknowledgement of Suttle's ownership and doomed him to a return to bondage.
2 days after Burns' arrest, abolitionists met in Boston to decide how to respond to the outrage. A large crowd of mostly white abolitionists met at Faneuil Hall. William Lloyd Garrison's abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, said that the meeting was crowded beyond the capacity of the building. George R. Russell opened the meeting, saying, "I once thought that a fugitive could never be taken from Boston. I was mistaken. One has been taken from among us, and another lies in peril of his liberty. The boast of the slaveholder is that he will catch his slaves under the very shadow of Bunker Hill. We have made compromises until we find that compromise is concession, and concession is degradation. The question has come at last whether the North will still consent to do what it is held base to do with the South." They debated courses of action for hours, whether to pursue strictly legal remedies, whether to block the streets with a human shield when the time came to move Burns, or whether simply to bear witness to the crime. A smaller group of mostly black abolitionists met at Tremont Temple, a few blocks away from the courthouse. This meeting was shorter and more decisive. Under the leadership of black abolitionist leader Lewis Hayden, subject of our last two podcasts, and of Thomas Higginson, who had organized the attempt to free Thomas Sims, the crowd at the Temple decided to march immediately to the courthouse and attempt to free Burns. As word reached Faneuil Hall, the meeting there began to break up as well, and the crowd around the courthouse quickly grew from hundreds to thousands. Higginson, Hayden, and a small group armed themselves with axes and a large beam that they used as a battering ram. They rushed the doors of the federal courthouse, hacking and battering open a small opening in the doors. A shot rang out, and a guard named William Batchelder was stabbed to death in the confusion. Higginson and a few others managed to make it to an interior corridor of the courthouse, where they were met by police and soldiers in force. Higginson said that they swung clubs, driving us to the wall and hammering away at our heads. The attempt was unsuccessful, and Burns remained in chains. Higginson would later defend the action, saying, "If no attempt had been made, we would have had the ineffable disgrace of seeing Burns marched down State Street under a corporal's guard only, amidst a crowd of irresolute semi-abolitionists, hooting, groaning, and never striking a blow. What paralyzes us in a slave case is the timidity of the majority, the irresolution of the rest, and the want of organization of all. Men must risk something. Not only risk danger, but even failure and disapprobation of critics. The great merit of the courthouse attempt is that it was an attempt. A few more defeats as that before the courthouse, and we shall have a victory."
After the attempt to free Burns, federal authorities were taking no chances when it came time to put him on a ship bound back to Virginia. The governor called out the state militia and armed the police, while President Franklin Pierce sent a contingent of U.S. Marines armed with a field gun. Mary Blanchard described the scene in a letter to her father, former Boston Mayor Benjamin Seaver. "This last week will long be remembered as a sad one by the citizens of Boston. Many times we have rejoiced that you were not in Boston in the capacity of mayor." On Friday, at 10 o'clock, the judge gave his decision in favor of the claimant, and immediately preparations were begun for taking him away. A steamer was in readiness at Long Wharf, and the mayor ordered out all the state military and police force and gave General Edmonds discretionary powers to keep the peace of the city. From 10 o'clock till 3, the streets from the wharf to the courthouse were lined with military, and State Street during all that time was impassable, so that businesses there were necessarily suspended. In the center of a hollow square formed of volunteers, about 200, all the worst blacklegs and pimps of the city, walked the slave, a good-looking fellow. Each one of these men had drawn a sword or knife. Several companies of soldiers marched before and behind, and the artillery had a 6-pound cannon all loaded. This procession was witnessed by thousands of spectators, and everywhere greeted with hisses and shouts. Many of the buildings were draped with black, and the Commonwealth Building had put out a black coffin with the word Liberty upon it. One of the police officers, Mr. J.K. Hayes, resigned his office on receiving orders to be one of that procession. Much blame is put upon the mayor for blockading the streets and putting the city under military law. Unlike the quiet and somber scene when Sims had been taken to the wharves, this time a mob of about 50,000 surrounded the armed procession, booing, hissing, and chanting, "Kidnappers! Kidnappers!" And it's worth noting at that time, the population of Boston was only about 130,000. This marked a turning point in Boston's political history. Leading businessmen and moderate Whigs, who may have backed Daniel Webster's support of the Fugitive Slave Act as a means to hold the Union together, felt betrayed by Southern slave power and its hold on the federal government. The entire state was on its way to becoming radicalized, willing to sacrifice the Union to fight the institution of slavery. From this moment, civil war became almost inevitable.
After Anthony Burns was returned to Virginia, Boston abolitionists offered Suttle up to $1,200 to purchase his freedom. Much as Potter, Thomas Sims' owner, had done, Suttle spurned any effort to purchase Burns' freedom. Instead, he chose to sell Burns at a loss to a North Carolina planter for $905, simply to make a bitter point. Reverend Leonard Grimes of the 12th Baptist Church refused to give up on Burns. Working through intermediaries, Reverend Grimes was able to purchase Anthony Burns by hiding the fact that the money was coming from abolitionists. He then immediately emancipated Burns. We'll have images in this week's show notes of the two checks totaling $1,300 that were used to buy Anthony Burns' freedom. If you recall last week's episode, the federal government attempted to prosecute 7 people in the successful rescue of Shadrach Minkins. After the failed rescue attempt of Anthony Burns, 3 of his allies were arrested. Thomas Higginson was among them, and he requested an immediate jury trial, saying, John Hancock was once a rebel. A grand jury indicted them, but one was acquitted, and the other two trials ended in hung juries. In the end, no Boston jury would ever return a guilty verdict against a defendant, white or black, who was charged with attempting to free a man accused of being a fugitive slave.
Ever since he was a young man, Anthony Burns had felt called to the ministry. When he was still enslaved, he preached the gospel to his fellow slaves at Falmouth Union Church in Virginia. After they purchased his freedom, members of the 12th Baptist Church used the proceeds from a book about the case to send Burns to college at Oberlin in Ohio. After a 2-year course of study in divinity, he became a minister in Indianapolis. Soon after, he answered the call of Zion Baptist Church in a small community in what was then called Upper Canada, today's Ontario, and became a pastor there. Anthony Burns died of tuberculosis in Canada on July 17, 1862, at the young age of 28.
On May 1, 1863, a story ran in the Liberator saying, "A returned fugitive slave again free. Thomas Sims, who was returned from Boston in 1851 to his master in Georgia under the fugitive slave law, arrived in Boston on Thursday of last week with his family. He came direct from Vicksburg, where he had been employed as a bricklayer, having escaped from that city about 3 weeks ago to General Grant's lines in a dugout with his wife, child, and 4 colored men." Thomas Sims was received as something of a hero in Boston with a large meeting at the Tremont Temple. We'll have an advertisement for that meeting in the show notes. He recounted the 12 years that had passed since he was re-enslaved and told the story of his escape. He and his family, along with 3 friends, had armed themselves, then floated along the Mississippi under cover of darkness, directly under the guns of a Confederate position, before finding their way to Union lines. Recognizing the propaganda value in Sims, the former fugitive, General Ulysses S. Grant gave his family a pass and sent them north to Boston. At that point, Wendell Phillips and William Lloyd Garrison took the stage and reminded the packed house that the fugitive slave law was still in effect, even as Massachusetts men fought and died to end slavery.
The end of the Fugitive Slave Act, and the end of slavery itself, was a slow progression as the Civil War ground on. In May of 1861, Union generals began to treat escaping slaves as contraband of war. This meant that they would take them in and prevent them from being retaken by the Confederates, with the thinking that every person who was no longer enslaved was one less person to support the Confederate economy. Congress passed a Confiscation Act in August of 1861, which made this emerging policy official. Union officers were authorized to seize property used to support the Confederate war effort, including human property. The vague text of law didn't technically free escaped slaves, so they became wards of the U.S. government, attached to the military units that seized them. Congress passed an act prohibiting the return of slaves in March of 1862, which declared that slaves from any territory occupied by federal troops were to be considered ipso facto free. However, border states, those that had remained loyal to the Union but still held people in slavery, were not affected, as they were not occupied enemy territory. Even the Emancipation Proclamation, issued on New Year's Day in 1863, was not enough. It freed all slaves in the Confederate states, but since it was issued as part of Lincoln's war powers, border states again were exempt. And northern states were still technically bound by the Fugitive Slave Act to return escaped slaves to their masters in the border states. Finally, Congress fully repealed the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act on June 28, 1864. The 13th Amendment was ratified in December of 1865, freeing all remaining people held in slavery in the territory of the United States. At that time, there were still tens of thousands of slaves in Kentucky and Delaware who were freed by the 13th Amendment.
Thomas Sims would return to the South again, this time voluntarily. While in Boston, he had tried to enlist in the Union Army, but by that time he was over 35 years old and not exactly a prime recruit. Instead of fighting in the South, he went south to recruit black troops. He went first to Nashville and later to Huntsville, Alabama, in the heart of Dixie. The Lowell Sun noted in December 1864, "Among the curiosities of the time, however, is the presence here in Nashville of Thomas Sims as a recruiting agent for colored troops. Thomas Sims, to send whom back to slavery, Boston got on its knees, shed its tears, and brandished its weapons, and the whole United States trembled and shook. He, who was in his day the most famous of martyrs, is now a quiet, energetic recruiting agent to aid that very government which exhausted all its warlike powers and all the resources of statesmanship to return him to a state of slavery.
I do take issue with the Lowell Sun here. I would say that Boston got on its feet, not on its knees. If anyone wants to find out more about Thomas Sims and Anthony Burns, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/016. We'll have portraits of both Sims and Burns, as well as pictures of the two checks used to purchase Anthony Burns' freedom. We'll link to the full text of Mary Blanchard's letter describing the troops protecting Anthony Burns' march to the waterfront, and to an 1856 book about Burns that includes pictures of the 12th Baptist Church, the mob attempting to storm the courthouse, and Burns' march to the water. We'll also link to Stephen Paleo's book, A City So Grand, which focuses on the transformation of Boston in the second half of the 19th century and opens with Thomas Sims' arrest. While you're on the site, make sure to click on the subscribe link to make sure you never miss an episode. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can click on Contact Us or send an email to podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. We'd love to read your feedback on the show.
We're going to be in Iceland next week, so we'll record what we're calling our Viking Minisode. The final Black History Month show will air the week after that. That's all for now. We'll be back in 2 weeks.